really for about 6 months now, and about stewardship. Now this is the sixth week, and I think five of these, counting today, have been on money and giving, a topic that the Bible has an awful lot to say about. We've been using the example of this special offering that was taken up to meet a significant need in the church in Jerusalem. The Christians in that church were really overwhelmed with financial burden, and so an offering was taken up from other churches around the world to meet that need. And from what we've looked at, we've seen that giving is to be a discipline in the life of a Christian. It's a planned, steady kind of giving. We're to set some aside each week as God prospers us, and if we'll all do that, there'll be enough. Now, in the instance that we've been looking at, it required everybody in multiple churches to do that, but when they did that, it was going to be enough, even to meet that need in Jerusalem. Paul said, if you just do this, then when I come, we won't need to take up an offering. It'll already be ready. And so we give that way as God prospers us. We do what we want to do. We give based on love and grace. What we want to give, we do that looking to Jesus' example. We're to be diligent and follow through on what we planned to do. You know, we have those good intentions, and Paul challenged us to bring them to fulfillment. We don't do this for the sake of giving. It's not that giving is this holy, mysterious act that gives you spiritual juice. You know, it's not that, okay, I'll give and then that's the blessing. It's the blessing in giving is worship. It's the blessing of meeting real needs. You know, there is a practical reason for this, not just the giving itself, which is sometimes emphasized, almost in a mystical kind of way. We learned that this process is overseen by biblically qualified leaders who have been tested, who have godly priorities, who are trying as much as human beings can to plan for the future, and that these leaders are to be confident in God's people, that God's people will respond to God and do what needs to be done. So that's a quick synopsis. And a lot of you have said to me over the last couple of weeks that this stuff about giving out of 1 and 2 Corinthians has been a blessing and an encouragement to you. I know it has to me, and I especially have been encouraged by the reminder that, for me personally anyway, that giving is from love and grace based on the example of Christ, and that it's not law and duty and obligation and here's what you have to do. But as encouraging as this look at giving has been in a lot of ways, it doesn't mean that actually doing it is always easy, does it? To give consistently over a long period of time, something out of every paycheck, giving sacrificially to meet somebody else's needs, to meet real needs, to support church activities, to give something of yours to somebody else who's hurting and needs it consistently over time, week after week, year after year. There are times when that is easy, but there are certainly times when that's not easy. Does anybody in the room know? Not you. Does anybody in the room know the lowest offering month of the year for charitable contributions in the United States of America? What's the lowest month?
January
by far, sometimes by as much as 40%. And that's here. I don't know about other places. It might be 80% in some places. February is a close second, but never as low as January. And then by March, it's back to normal. Why is that?
Taxes.
Paying off Christmas debt. Christmas. It has been it's been something that I've scratched my head about over the years, what the celebration of the Lord's birth does to church attendance in December and to church giving in January. Now, I don't bring this up because I'm going to put you under the law again. We undid that curse, or that misconception, I should say, a few weeks ago. I just bring it up to point out the fact that this is not always easy. To give consistently week after week is not always easy. Even when our incomes are consistent, it's just not always easy to give consistently because things come up. Christmas comes up. Other expenses come up. You know, maybe you spent a little more than you meant to on Christmas, or something else. You know, maybe there were some bills you hadn't anticipated. You planned for some maintenance issues, but oh my goodness, that one was 8 times what we had planned for the whole year, and they want that just to give me my car back. And so you have stuff like that that comes up. Things have to be repaired. Sometimes there are medical bills, and those can escalate very quickly, even if it's not a life-altering event. So I'm just saying that it's hard. It can be hard because of the stuff that comes up, and it can also be hard because of the stuff you want. You want things that you don't have, right? Or most people do. And if you're giving something significant out of your check every week or every time you get a check, then you're doing without something big. For most people who give, you know, you're talking about another car or a boat or, you know, something big on your list of things to want that that you're giving away. And so even with all of the encouragement that we've had, we may need a little more because it's not always easy to be faithful. We need some clearly articulated reasons to grab hold of so that when it's hard to give, we still want to give, right? We're supposed to do this because we want to. Now, there's been a lot of that. You know, the call to steady giving is an encouragement because it came with that reminder that if we'll all just do that, then we won't need a pep rally event to try and raise this big offering. When Paul gets to town, it'll be there. The example of the Macedonian churches that Paul mentioned was an encouragement because these guys gave out of their poverty and they wanted to give. They wanted to do it. They asked for the opportunity to participate. That reminder that giving was based in love and grace and not law, pointing specifically to Jesus' example of becoming poor that we might be rich. It was a great encouragement. The reminder that real needs have to be met by somebody, and if God has given you something right now, you can meet the needs now, and you might be the guy who benefits later from someone else's generosity. That was a good reminder. There's the picture of godly leadership we looked at last time that had encouragement in it. Just the ability to trust God to work in His people. So there's been a lot, but Paul isn't finished yet with giving us encouragement because this issue of how we handle our money is a big issue in our relationship with God. And so Paul wraps up this section on giving with what really becomes the ultimate encouragement for those who are willing to give. He reminds us that God Himself is our provider, and He assures us that God is going to give us the resources that we need to continue to be a blessing. Our text for this morning is 2 Corinthians 9, 6 through 15. This finishes the section in 2 Corinthians on giving, and it'll finish our look at this part of the disciplined Christian life anyway. 2 Corinthians 9, beginning with verse 6. Now this I say, He who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Each one must do just as he has purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that always having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance in every good deed, an abundance for every good deed. As it is written, he scattered abroad, he gave to the poor, his righteousness endures forever. Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in everything for all liberality, which through us is producing thanksgiving to God. For the ministry of this service is not only fully supplying the needs of the saints, but it is also overflowing through many thanksgivings to God. Because of the proof given by this ministry, they will glorify God for your obedience to your confession of the gospel of Christ and for the liberality of your contribution to them and to all, while they also, by prayer on your behalf, yearn for you because of the surpassing grace of God in you. Thanks be to God for his indescribable gift. Now, Paul begins this final appeal about giving, this final part of his appeal, with a very obvious truth from agriculture. You may have heard somebody relate the laws of the harvest before. You harvest what you plant. You plant corn, you're going to get corn. It works that way every time. You harvest after you plant. You know, you put it in the ground and you have to wait a while and then you get it. You harvest more than you plant. But this one is, that Paul emphasizes here is that you harvest in proportion to what you plant. Put in a little bit, you get a little bit. It's more than what you put in the ground, but it's still little compared to what it would have been if you had planted more. A farmer who buys a little bit of seed, who only makes the effort to plow a little bit of land, gets a little harvest. A farmer who makes a big commitment, either to keep the seed from this year or to buy seed when it's time, plows a lot of ground, works a lot more, puts more in the dirt, that one gets a much bigger harvest. So, how the farmer plans and what the farmer is willing to do in terms of putting seed in the dirt has a direct bearing on the harvest, right? That's obvious. That's how farming works. There's nothing complicated about that. But Paul isn't talking about farming. He's talking about giving, and this is an illustration of giving. And he tweaks the wording just a little bit to make sure we all understand. He's still talking about giving. It's not an interruption in the line of thought to give you a quick lesson in farming. It's an illustration. He says, when the word that's translated bountifully in the NASB in the Greek is eulogia. Our word eulogy comes from this Greek word. It means a blessing. It's a benefit bestowed by God in this use. And so the point of the wording from the context is obvious. If you'll, how you plan and what you're willing to commit in terms of giving has a direct bearing on your blessing from God. If you invest a little, you get a little. It's more than you invested, but it's still small. You didn't plow much, and so you don't take much time harvesting. If you invest a lot, you get a bountiful blessing from God. Now, Paul is making this statement as an obvious truism. It's plain, it's simple. This is how giving works. And so it's a good reminder to us that there are consequences in the future. You know, when you put that seed in the dirt, you've said goodbye to that seed forever. It's not going to be in that form useful to you ever again. You wait for the blessing to come, and it's that way with giving. Now, Paul follows this obvious reality up with an immediate challenge, or an immediate caution, I should say. It's in verse 7. It says, "But each one must do just as he has purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. Now, this comes right behind the promise, the reminder, the obvious truism that you receive blessing in proportion to what you give. And immediately we get this caution: each one must do just as he has purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion. Now, this statement rules out a lot of the kind of foolishness that people would take verse 6 to try to prove to you and have that to back it up. You're to do what you've purposed in your heart. You're not to do this grudgingly. So you can't be resentful about your giving. If you are, this truism in verse 6 doesn't apply. That's why this caution comes so quick. If you're doing it and you're sorry about it, you're not in this field that he's talking about. We have to keep watch on our hearts, you know, especially in those times when it's hard. It's January and I am so broke, but I have to give. And so you do this grudgingly. You put yourself back under that law that we talked about a few weeks ago. We really have to check our hearts, because the blessing doesn't apply if we're not giving because we want to. It says not grudgingly. And it also says not under compulsion. So you're not giving because you're being manipulated into doing it by some slick-talking guy in the front. You're not giving because everybody around you is doing it and you don't want to be the one who's not. You're not giving, and here's the one everybody runs with, you're not giving because your own greed compels you to give. This is the give to get mindset. This passage is not offering you an investment scheme by which you can attain more stuff for this world. Now, that's the hook that false teachers use to try and compel you to give more and more and more all the time to their ministry, of course, because that's the one that God's going to bless. And they present this as the way to be rich in this life, to have everything that you want, and they're appealing to greed. And if that compels you to give, then that your purpose really wasn't to give, was it? Purpose was to get. And so this agricultural illustration doesn't apply. You didn't put your seed in the dirt and walk away never to have it again in that form. You made an investment. You're trying to give it and keep it at the same time, which isn't giving. Strictly speaking, that isn't giving. You're still attached to it. Your expectation is that you're going to get a return. You bought a bond. You invested in a stock, but you didn't give. When you give, it's more like the farmer. You're going to get nothing out of that seed unless the future crop comes. It's in the dirt. You're not going to grind it up and make bread out of it now. You're committed. So when you give, you're letting it go. It's not yours anymore. Now, you're to do this because you want to do it. That's this immediate caution. It says God loves a cheerful giver. God is the one who gives the bountiful blessing, and he's looking at the attitude of your heart. Now, this means that we need to keep a check on that. So then the question is, well, how do I do that? How do I attain that? It's one thing for me to give by discipline. I can manage that easier now than I used to could. You know, I'm okay. I kind of just get in this routine. I can be disciplined, but cheerful? That one doesn't come as easy, does it? How do you get there? Well, in the next verses, Paul points us to the only reliable source for this cheerfulness that God loves in us as we give. In verses 8 and 9, it says, "And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that always having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every good deed. As it is written, he scattered abroad, he gave to the poor, his righteousness endures forever." Now, if we can get firmly fixed in our hearts the meaning of these two verses, then cheerful will be the result in our giving. We'll be excited about that opportunity to give. We might be like the Philippians, the Macedonian Christians who wanted to give. No, don't leave us out of the offering. This is strong encouragement if we understand it. It says, God is able. This is the thing that Paul is pointing us to so that we can give cheerfully, so that we don't fall into those traps about money, including the greed factor. God is able. Paul doesn't point us to principles and rules and laws and what we ought to do. And he doesn't say, do this even though you don't want to, because it'll be good for you. He says, here's how to be cheerful. God loves a cheerful giver, and you need to remember that God is able. He says God is able to make all grace abound to you. This is an encouragement for you to want to do this even when it seems hard. God is able to make all grace abound to you. When it's hard to make ends meet, this helps. God is the source, not just of your physical resources, but of the grace that we long for, of all of the blessings that we long for. It even says, so that always having all sufficiency in everything. It's still talking about you. That's a pretty high standard, isn't it? All sufficiency in everything. Wow. Sounds pretty good. Abounding in grace, sufficient in everything. Now, we appear to be in a time when a financial struggle is imminent, even if we haven't personally felt it yet. It's coming on more and more, seems like. Maybe you're having a hard time right now financially. And if you are, or if you face that in the coming months, it will help to remember that many of the wealthiest people in this world do not have what Paul is describing here. Their lives are a mess. They're not content. They have no peace. Rich and poor alike need what verse 8 is talking about. And it says God is able to give it to you. Now, this obviously includes financial resources, but it mentions grace abounding to you as well. He gives you the material comforts that you have. He gives you the grace that you need. And he does this for a purpose in your life. Its purpose is also mentioned in verse 8. So that, always having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance. Why? For every good deed. God blesses you in order to make you a blessing. You ever wonder why you're blessed? The people that I have known over the years who are the least happy often have had the most money. But there's an attitude that's prevalent in the people that I'm thinking about, and I've seen, dozens and dozens. And the attitude is that if I get more, then God is blessing me. Often they talk about God. They're professing Christians. But the attitude is God is blessing me so that I can enjoy an ever-increasing lifestyle. Now, maybe not articulated, but obviously the framework of their thinking. The reason I have this is so I can have this. And, I'll be happy if I can just get a little more, because this isn't quite doing it for me. And so we got to have this addition. We've got to indulge in these extra activities. And then, of course, that's when happy is going to come. And so then there's, well, we got there. That wasn't quite it. We need to add this. We need to add this. And, well, God isn't blessing you so that you can enjoy an ever-increasing lifestyle. That isn't why. It's so that you can abound in every good deed. It's for you to be a blessing. And when you think that way and you try to bless others, you find that the blessing does come and that you're more content than you were when you were pursuing that continual improvement in lifestyle, even beyond, I mean, there's just never an end to that. There's never enough in that framework of thinking. So this says God is able to give you what you need so that you can continue to use the resources you have to be a blessing to others. And you're not going to run out when you're doing that. Now, the first week we talked about money. We looked at Proverbs 11, 24, and 25. That reminder that there's more to this than math because God is involved. Those verses say there's one who scatters and yet increases all the more. And there's one who withholds what is justly due and yet it results only in want. The generous man will be prosperous, and he who waters will himself be watered. You need encouragement when it's hard to be disciplined in giving and to be cheerful about it. This is it. God is able to give you everything that you need so that you can be a blessing. There is another important reminder here, though. And it's also it's that God is also willing. God is able, and God is willing. Verse 9 shows us that it is God's very character to give generously. It says, He scattered abroad, He gave to the poor. His righteousness endures forever. Two of those lines are past tense. He scattered abroad, He gave to the poor. Significant. He already did this. God has a track record. He's been generous before. He scatters it. He gives to people who need it. He gives to the poor. He's already done it. Past tense. And then it says His righteousness endures forever. Now at first glance, that looks like a whole other subject, right? What do you stick that in there for? We've written 20 lines and didn't mention an attribute of God, and so we got to put a line in? No. What it's saying is, hello, God hasn't changed. His righteousness endures forever. It doesn't diminish. His character is not altered. If He did it before, He's doing it now. He'll do it in the future. God doesn't change. He's still scattering. He's still giving to the poor. This is His character. So, if your giving makes you poor, which is what we fear, right? Well, guess what? God still gives to the poor. He's already proven it. He doesn't change. He never will change. If you become poor by being faithful to Him, He'll be the one who gives to you whatever you need. That's how He is. That's how He's always been. He'll never change. God is able, and God is willing. He has proven character. You can depend on it. Now, at this point in this appeal that Paul is making, he kind of brings it home to us in a whole new way. He says that it is God who makes the harvest possible. He's going back again to this farming illustration. Have you ever thought about how farming works? Have you ever done any gardening? Even just a little bit, you dig up the dirt. You know, it's just dirt. And you take a wrinkled up seed, a bunch of them, and you put them in the dirt, and you cover them up. You bury a shriveled up seed in the dirt. You could have done something else with it. You could have eaten it. You could have ground it into flour and made bread and eaten it. You could have sold it to someone else. It has value before you put it in the dirt. But you bury it in the ground. And then a process takes place with which you have absolutely nothing to do. You don't control it. You don't initiate it. You don't understand it. Even today, no one can tell you why some seeds germinate and some don't. We don't really understand all of it. We do some, but not all of it. We don't get the whole process. We know how it works, and so we can plan, but we really don't know why it works. We don't know exactly what God is doing in there. There's a process going on that has no human agent involved after we bury it in the dirt. And that process takes place all by itself, and a crop is eventually produced, and you get to harvest that crop. Paul goes back to this illustration to show you that this God who is able and willing is the God who is making your giving effective when you're faithful to do it. Verse 10, he's still talking about God now. It says, "Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in everything for all liberality, which through us is producing thanksgiving to God." He's talking about farming, but not really. He's talking about your giving. He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in everything for all liberality. There wouldn't be any seed to plant if God didn't make this process work. You know, you run out after a year. You're done. The world would starve. There's a system there that God makes work, that the farmer takes advantage of. And this is the God who supplies your seed for sowing so that you can reap this harvest of righteousness. If God hadn't already been generous in your life, you wouldn't have anything to give. God enables your harvest by giving you the seed to begin with. You didn't earn it. You worked for it, but God made you able to work. God gave you the ability to earn. God enables the harvest by giving the seed and by making this process happen that we don't have anything to do with. And he increases the harvest of your righteousness, this text says. Now, we should marvel at the process of taking a dried up seed and putting it in the dirt, and it grows into a fruit tree. You know, one apple seed, how many apples? Thousands and thousands, if it's a productive tree. One little shriveled up seed put in the dirt. We ought to marvel at that. That is a wonderful thing, but that is nothing compared to what this verse, this passage is talking about. Verse 10 says that God increases the harvest of your righteousness. Your righteousness. And verse 11 says you will be enriched in everything for all liberality. We're just talking about money, right? Just the money that runs through the sieve so quickly at your house like it does at mine. It's just that, right? Just a little bit of money every week out of your check. But by a process that you don't control, God uses that money to increase the harvest of your righteousness. And you will be enriched in everything for all liberality. Still, that purpose is there. You're enriched for liberality. You get the harvest of righteousness. You get more resources with which to be generous. Now, a lot of people scoff at this whole line of thinking that Paul is giving us, especially the cheerful giving line. I've heard a lot of people mock that over the years. You can almost hear the snide comments just if you just read through this. The tape plays, the stuff you've heard over the years from people who mock biblical giving. that prevailing attitude, I think, is proof enough that God is the one who has to do this work we're talking about. If somebody can do what this is talking about and can give cheerfully, trusting that God's going to provide for our needs, then that's a work of God in the human heart. And I think that may be why the last thing that Paul emphasizes in this section on giving in 2 Corinthians is our worship of God that results from faithful giving. Only God can do this in the human heart. This attitude about money that we're reading about is a supernatural work. If we really get it and we can give cheerfully and generously and even sacrifice and be happy to do it, that's a God thing. And so the end of verse 11, it says, which through us is producing thanksgiving to God. When people see this happening in your life, people who understand worship God as a result of what they see in you. It produces thanksgiving, not just in you, but in the other people who realize the faithfulness they're seeing. In verse 12, it says, for the ministry of this service is not only fully supplying the needs of the saints, but is also overflowing through many thanksgivings to God. That's worship. This normal, ordinary money is meeting practical needs, producing righteousness in you, and generating thanksgiving to God and others who see faithfulness demonstrated in the life of a Christian. Verse 13, it says, because of the proof given by this ministry, they will glorify God for your obedience to the confession of the gospel of Christ and for the liberality of your contribution to them and to all. So the people in Jerusalem are going to get this gift. They're going to know that some of it came from a church in Corinth. And they're going to worship God who met their needs through those people, many of whom they don't know. Most of them, they wouldn't have any connection other than we're all Christians. We haven't met yet. They're glorifying God. They're worshiping God because God met their needs through other Christians who were faithful. This kind of giving results in God honoring worship. In verse 14, it says, while they also, by prayer on your behalf, yearn for you because of the surpassing grace of God in you. They're praying more because they've recognized faithfulness in other Christians. It's worship. It's a right relationship with God when we go to Him in prayer and when we're thanking Him. When we're glorifying Him, those things are all mentioned here in this part. And then in the last verse of the chapter, Paul breaks out in his own worship, just writing about this for a couple of chapters now. He says, thanks be to God for His indescribable gift. This is a work of God in the human heart. It's evidence that salvation is actually there. It's something that God uses in our lives to produce righteousness. People see the change in us and the effect of our faithfulness, and they glorify God, and they're praying more. And Paul, just thinking about all of that, says, thanks be to God for His indescribable gift. Well, I want to get some feedback from you in the time that we have left. I had a couple of questions for you, and then we'll see if you have any questions or comments beyond these. What do you think is the significance of the phrase in verse 13, because of the proof given by this ministry? What is he talking about there? Because of the proof given by this ministry, they will glorify God for your obedience to your confession of the gospel of Christ. What's that mean?
The ESV says, by their approval of the service.
Are there approval of this service? Yeah, I think the Greek there is liturgo. So it's just a worship word. Liturgy comes from. I think that's the word in verse 13. I know it is in 12. Yeah, I think ministry is that. All right, so somebody give me another angle on this. Because of the proof given by this ministry, or another version, that was ESV?
That was ESV.
Somebody got New King James? Any ideas what he's talking about?
He's talking about the collection.
He's talking about the gifts. Okay. How does that prove anything? That is what he's talking about. What does it prove?
Proves that they were obedient.
Right heart.
That giving itself is a ministry. Proving the promises.
Yeah, that's right. So, think about where everybody is, right? What racial/religious background are these needy Christians in Jerusalem?
Jewish.
Predominantly Jewish.
This was a Gentile church giving.
Yeah. What's Corinth? Yeah. Not many Jews in Corinth compared to in Jerusalem. So what are the Jews thinking if they're not just real progressive?
<Yeah. laughs> they had a hard time believing that the Gentiles were true Christians.
Yeah. Yeah, wouldn't they? Wouldn't they be going, I don't know, man. I thought, you know, you had to be Jewish first, right? This was a big deal. They had to have a whole council about it in Acts 15. Don't they need to be Jews? Some people were saying, yeah, they need to be Jews. You know, it's Jews plus Jesus. That was their struggle. And don't think the people in Corinth weren't aware of it either. You had the Judaizers following Paul around, which, you know, they were Jews without Jesus, but they were saying you have to be Jews. They were trying to put people back under that law. And so the people in Corinth probably knew that some of the Jews had a hard time accepting them as real Christians. And here's a practical demonstration that your faith is real. And Paul is saying they're going to get this gift and they're going to know that you're really changed, that you're really serious about walking with the Lord. Salvation is proven in works, isn't it? You know what James is talking about in chapter 2? What use is it if you see somebody hungry or in need of clothing and you say to them, go, be warm and be filled and don't give them what they need? What good is that? That's not real religion. So, I mean, the proof, it really is proof. Your Christianity has to have proof in your life. You know, it isn't real if it doesn't show up. Now, that's pretty edgy stuff in 2009 in the United States, but the church needs to be screaming it from the rooftops. If you can't live it, you don't have it. We need to quit pretending people are Christians if they don't have something that changes their lives. And Paul is saying they're going to know that your faith is real by these actions. Why do you think in verse 14, Paul mentions this result of their praying for the Corinthians? It says, while they also, by prayer on your behalf, yearn for you because of the surpassing grace of God in you. What's that about? I know I'm putting a lot on you on this short night you had last night, but hey.
There's a bond in the brotherhood that's created through this. And you think about it, otherwise, were this ministry not going on, they're in their separate places and separate lives, Jerusalem and Corinth, and it creates a shared bond, a shared yearning, a shared love for each other. You got to know the recipients are praying for those.
Yeah, I think that's it. There is a bond. What produces the closest bonds that you have with other Christians? What kind of things? You know, showing up at church on Sunday?
Time, sharing resources.
Yeah.
Common goals.
I think the two that I thought of are working together and having somebody meet your needs. You know, if you serve with somebody, alongside somebody, and doing something for something else, there's a bond between these two servants that is different from anything you can get in the normal activity of coming together. A closer bond. You know, we went there and we did that together. We met that guy's need and together. We prayed together. We labored in prayer together. There's a bond that comes in that. But there's also a very close bond that comes when you are desperate and some Christian comes and says, let me fix that for you. And that's the one that he's referring to here. You know, they're praying for you now. They don't know you yet, mostly, but there's a bond now because you gave to them and now they're tied to you and they're motivated to pray. If you've ever been in desperate straits, either financially or just overwhelmed, you know, in some medical situation or some other kind of just major change in your schedule that just overwhelmed you and some Christians stepped up to help in practical ways, either with money or time, does it not tie your heart to their hearts? That's what he's talking about. Any other comments or questions on this passage? All right, well, let me lead us in prayer and we'll be dismissed.